You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the future of the International Space Station is an open question with deadlines coming up in a couple years and concerns over international cooperation. We'll get the latest from Earth's orbit. Now the trade deadline for the Major League Baseball season was last night, and the Milwaukee Brewers made a big shakeup this week. They traded their closer, all-star pitcher Josh Hader, to the San Diego Padres in exchange for two major league pitchers and two minor league prospects. The move got mixed reactions. Some fans questioned why the team would trade away one of its top relief pitchers while sitting in first place in their division, making another playoff run. Brewers President of Baseball Operations David Stern said the trade is about sustaining success.
Today's trade, as we said in the release, is about doing everything we can as an organization to continue our mission and our goal of giving our team as many bites at the apple as we possibly can to sustain competitiveness and to avoid some of the down cycles that we've seen throughout baseball in the not too distant past.
We're checking out that trade and what's in store for the rest of the Brewers season. Dominic Catriano is a statistician for Bally Sports Wisconsin, host of the Locked On Brewers podcast. Dominic, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, I ask you the question I'm guessing a lot of Brewers fans are asking: why? Why this Hader trade?
Well, you know, Brewers fans have been used to hearing Josh Hader's name in trade conversations, it feels like, since 2019 when he first took the closer role. Why now? It's because his value probably was at its peak right now. You give a chance to sell him for a playoff run to a team like the Padres who needs help in the bullpen, and you get to add some prospects. Let's say the worst case scenario, the Murphy's Law, everything that can go wrong will go wrong, and that, let's say, Hader gets hurt in the second half or he continues his struggles like he had in July. All of a sudden, all that value that you had built up may not quite be there for the Brewers that they knew they were going to have to trade him. The Brewers have always operated as a small market team, understanding that they're not going to be able to pay superstars like other teams could in the future. And Hader's heading into his final year of his contract next season, in which he's likely to become the richest arbitration eligible reliever in baseball history. So the Brewers were not excited to make that trade yesterday. And it got an even interesting twist today, as one of the big leaguers that returned, Dinelson Lamet, was actually designated for assignment, AKA cut from the roster today.
Now, fans might ask, but we're in a playoff run now. Doesn't this potentially have a downside if the Brewers stay in first place and are trying to go as far as they can into the playoffs?
It's a very fair criticism. And you're losing Josh Hader, who, as many baseball analysts say, is the best closer in baseball. He has been lights out. July aside, when he's had a weird month, but he is one of the best in the biz. But to David Stearns and Matt Arnold's credit, the brass of the Brewers front office, they did acquire another closer back in this trade. The other big leaguer is Taylor Rogers. Plenty of big league experience as a closer. In fact, he is second on the National League leaderboard behind Josh Hader for the most saves in baseball in the National League. So it's not like they're bringing in somebody who doesn't have experience. And furthermore, they feel confident to have Devin Williams save multiple games the rest of the season. He has been the guy that closes games when Josh Hader isn't available, like we've seen earlier this year. They are confident with their depth in the bullpen right now. And as we look toward the playoffs, the bullpens are what truly matters. You can have a great starting staff, but it tends to have starting pitchers get yanked a little early in the playoffs. Having a deep bullpen could be a huge key for the Brewers to finally get back to the World Series since the first time since 1982.
Now, for the casual fan who's maybe a little in and out early in the season, now the Brewers are in first place, hoping to stay there. Give us a sense, strengths and weaknesses of the team as they come into the home stretch here.
The strengths of the team is that they have a lot of power. In fact, they're in the top three in all of baseball for home runs hit as a club. They hit three home runs yesterday against the Pirates. They have a lot of power up and down the order. There are plenty of guys that can hit homers. Three of them already have over 20: Rowdy Tellez, Willy Adames, and Hunter Renfroe. Furthermore, they're getting healthier. They've only had a total of something like 17, 18 games all season, in which they've had their main complement of position players that they acquired this offseason healthy and eligible to play in a game. And furthermore, Christian Yelich in the leadoff spot has been a huge boost for the Brewers, finding out that, you know what, maybe the Brewers shouldn't be relying on Christian Yelich for power like we saw in 2018 and 2019, but relying for him getting on base and stealing bases and using his base running ability as opposed to the lack of power he's had. So him in the leadoff spot and the reemergence of health really can keep the Brewers offense going in the right direction. And of course, the strength of the big three of the starting rotation, Corbin Burns, the reigning Cy Young Award winner. Brandon Woodruff has returned from injury strong. And tonight, we see Freddy Peralta return from injury against the Pittsburgh Pirates. So those three starters, any team in the big leagues would take those three. And the lineup is getting deeper. And health has been a big part of the Brewers all year. And in these final 2 months, looks like they're going to be healthy.
Okay, that sounds pretty rosy. No team is perfect. What are some of the worries that people worry that the Brewers might trip up on the way into the playoffs?
Well, with home runs come strikeouts, and the Brewers are in the top half of the National League in strikeouts as a team. So it's not that surprising to see a lot of strikeouts, but the Brewers work a lot of counts. That's how they build their team. That's how they build their offensive approach. They see the most pitches per plate appearance in baseball. They're a very patient team. They don't chase a lot, but at the same time, they still strike out, swing and miss, pitches in the zone, pitches out of the zone. It doesn't matter. The biggest weakness that will be hurting the Brewers is the bottom half of the order, and maybe the lack of depth position player wise. As we've seen this year, when players are hurt, they don't exactly have replacement level players ready to go to keep the winning times going. June was a really tough month for the Brewers. They're getting things going again here in the second half, but if there is another injury in these final 59 games, it will be tough for the Brewers to absorb it.
All right, and again, for those casual fans, a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being, whatever, 10 being, get in there now because this is going to be a great year. What number should they be thinking about?
I'd be thinking 7.5. Okay. I know there's been a lot of animosity about this Josh Hader trade and folks worried about, oh my goodness, just traded an all-star closer. But this is still a very exciting team. And as we saw with the Braves last year, they were an under 500 team 100 games into the season, and they won the World Series. All you got to do is get hot at the end of September into October, and anything can happen. Just got to punch your ticket and get into the playoffs. And that's what the Brewers are looking for the rest of the year.
Dominic, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. Appreciate it.
That's Dominic Catronio, statistician for Bally Sports Wisconsin, host of the Locked On Brewers podcast. He's with us today to break down the Milwaukee Brewers trade of closer Josh Hader and what's in store for the rest of their season. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about kids and their beloved farm animals.
It's peak county fair season in Wisconsin. For many children at the Dane County Fair, it's more than the tilt-a-whirl and deep-fried treats. The event showcases all their hard work as they show their arts and crafts and animals, ranging from the smallest guinea pigs to the fully grown beef cattle. Christina Leffring spoke with some of the children about the lessons learned.
Go to any county fair and there's a lot going on. The rides, the food, and the music. But personally, I'm a sucker for the 4-H animal shows. In one morning at the Dane County Fair, I saw 12-year-old Brooklyn Carlson give her duck Biscuit a bath. 18-year-old Leah Hutchhausen was shearing her sheep Steve. And 9-year-old Layla Merrill led her massive, fully grown cow she's nicknamed Steamy after a special gift the cow gave her one cold morning. And I got an earful from Monopoly, the dairy cow who wants all the attention.
Yeah, she's quite the talker.
That's Morgan Cooper from Sun Prairie. Monopoly is not hers, but is tied up on the same row with the other DeForest 4-H Club's dairy cattle, including Morgan's calf, Elvira.
She is a very special animal to me, and I kind of call her like my puppy sometimes because she just follows me around, and she's really sweet.
Morgan is 17, so she is about to age out of the program. She's learned a lot about public speaking, community service, and the hard work that goes into training an animal.
I've been working with her for a couple of months now, and it for sure started very, very bad. She was definitely a little on the crazy side, but I think it's just spending time with them and having that bond, it brings happiness to people, honestly.
And Morgan's almost an adult. Kids can start showing dairy calves when they're as young as 9, like Abby Janish from DeForest, who showed for the first time with her calf, Daphne.
She normally is sweet, but she can get really sassy. She won't listen to me where I won't be able to hold her head up. Getting loose like 3 times, try to run me into buildings, machinery.
Have you enjoyed raising her though?
Yes.
Even with all her attitude?
Uh-huh.
Why?
Because we both have attitude.
Showing farm animals is seen as an activity mainly for kids living on farms, but that's not true these days. Not many of the kids with the DeForest 4-H Club are growing up in the country, much less on a working farm, even though many of their parents did. Abby's family is an exception. She lives across the street from her grandparents' dairy farm, and her mom, Vicki Janish, describes their home as a funny farm, with beef cattle, pigs, and chickens. But she and other area farmers make room on their farms for area kids to keep their show animals.
That's what's really cool about 4-H, is that it's a melting pot for opportunities. So if a child has interest in pigs or dairy or goats or sheep or whatever it may be, there's somebody in their local community that they can talk to and learn from. So we have 3 kids showing from our farm. We're giving them the opportunity to do what they are interested in.
Abby went a step further. She grew vegetables in a garden and sold them at a roadside stand so she could buy one of her 2 pigs she's showing, named Latte and Pumpkin Spice. And just like how her family helps kids who want to learn about dairy cattle, her neighbors taught her about pigs.
We don't know anything about pigs, so the families that are in our community really rallied behind her, and so that's what we get to do in the dairy side too, is we're trying to mentor and educate and expand their knowledge about agriculture.
After the fair, Abby will keep Latte for breeding, but Pumpkin Spice will be sold for meat, which is another important lesson. How to let go of the animals they've raised.
Are you sad about losing one of your pigs?
No, not really.
What helped you prepare for letting one of your pigs go?
Thinking of brats.
Another important lesson?
What?
Know where your favorite food comes from.
What?
Christina Leffring brought us that story from the Dane County Fair. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, a space policy expert explains what's going on with Russia's plans for the International Space Station. Some panicky headlines about the future of the station, but she says we need some clarification on that. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Cooperation between the U.S. and Russia is difficult these days after the Russian invasion of Ukraine and the American role in leading the international effort to supply arms and other aid to the Ukrainian military. Do those difficulties extend into space and the International Space Station in particular? A lot of headlines last week suggested a big change of Russian policy and a threat by Russia's space agency to abruptly leave the space station in 2024. But our next guest says, hang on. The Russian space agency was pretty much confirming things we already knew, including the expiration of the current plans to keep the station going through 2024. Plus, it's been up in the air for years whether Russia will commit to staying longer. Well, there's a good chance that other ISS partnering countries will. It gets complicated. Our next guest is here to sort things out about what's going on in orbit. Marcia Smith is the founder and editor of SpacePolicyOnline.com. She has more than 4 decades of experience in space policy, including at the Congressional Research Service, the Space Studies Board, and the Aeronautics and Space Engineering Board of the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. Marcia, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for inviting me.
So, yeah, some of those initial headlines, pretty panicky. What was really going on with this statement from Russian Space Administration leaders?
Well, the Russian Space Agency, Roscosmos, has a new leader. On July 15th, the guy who was running it, Dmitry Rogozin, who was a very bombastic fellow and often threatened to leave the ISS, was replaced by Yuri Borisov. And Borisov met with Putin and they made it public, which is unusual. And he said to Putin that, according to the reports from Russia, that Russia was gonna leave the space station after 2024. But that got reported outside of Russia that they were gonna leave in 2024, which is very different. And so there were all these headlines about Russia was gonna be leaving precipitously, which caused a lot of concern because the space station really is an interdependent facility, a Russian part and an American part that really need to work together. But it was a misunderstanding of what he was saying. And he did an interview with Russian TV a couple days later to clarify that he just meant they were going to be leaving after 2024 and everyone's going to be leaving after 2024.
Right. Talk about that timeline. What is significant about after 2024 for the International Space Station?
So the International Space Station has been there for quite some time. It's been permanently occupied by crews, international crews, including Russians and Americans, for over 20 years. So it's getting old. Everybody knows it's getting old. And right now, all the partners, that's Russia, the United States, Canada, Japan, and Europe, have agreed to operate it through 2024. But the United States is trying to get everybody to agree to keep it going till 2030, hoping that by then there'll be new commercial space stations where people can continue their research. So the United States is leading this effort to get everybody agree to 2030. And we have now made that commitment. We made it twice. President Biden announced it on December 31st. And then Congress has just passed a law last week in law extending the US commitment to 2030. And Canada and Japan and Europe are all expected to agree also. But Russia has been an outlier. They haven't been willing to come forward and say, yes, we're definitely staying until 2030. So that's why there's a little bit of concern about what their plans are.
Right. Given, you know, the resources all the different parties bring to the table here, can the space station be maintained until 2030 without Russia involved?
It would be extremely difficult. It is an interdependent facility. And among the things, for example, is that on the Russian side of it, they have propulsion. You have to lift the space station up in orbit periodically because the atmosphere drags it down. So you have to do these periodic reboosts, and you have to move the space station to avoid space debris from time to time. And the propulsion to do that is on the Russian end. And the US segment, it has the electrical power. It has these gigantic solar arrays that provide electrical power for the space station. So it's just two examples of how it's interdependent, but it'd be very difficult for us to replace the Russian propulsion capability. NASA says that it has some contingency plans in the works, but they haven't made them public. And it's not quite clear what they could get ready in time if Russia were to leave as early as 2024.
We're talking to Marcia Smith from spacepolicyonline.com, looking at the International Space Station, its future and international cooperation there. Marcia, there are lots of things floating around in orbit. There are lots of satellites. This one has humans on it, though, which makes it very distinctive. What is the argument for having, you know, people in a station of some sort, whether it's the ISS or something TBD after it?
Well, there's a lot of research that really requires human involvement. There's some that you can do without it, but there's a lot that you really need to have a scientist right there, just like we do here on Earth. So they're doing research that will benefit both people here on Earth and people who want to go further in space. So right now, the United States and some of its other partners are planning a return to the moon and someday to go on to Mars. And if you're gonna have humans doing that, then you need to understand how they react to long durations in weightlessness and the kind of, you know, conditions that you have in space flight. So it's really two-pronged. One is to do the scientific research that really requires having an on-site presence of a human being, and also to study how humans react, because humans are going to explore beyond Earth orbit.
And you mentioned the ISS. Even if we go to 2030, it's old. It's not going to be there forever. What kind of plans are in the works for future space stations?
So NASA is hoping that commercial companies are going to come forward and build their own space stations. NASA is going to facilitate it. They're going to provide some of the money, but they want to do it as public-private partnerships. NASA has gone all in on public-private partnerships. That's how they did the commercial crew program for taking astronauts back and forth to the space station, SpaceX's Crew Dragon. That was done as a public-private partnership. They do it with cargo. They're doing it for many aspects of the Artemis program to go back to the moon. And for space stations, they're gonna do the same thing. So they basically are gonna help companies. There are four companies that they're working with right now to build much smaller space stations. And NASA will just rent the capacity that it needs from them. So NASA won't own it. They'll just buy whatever services they need. And those companies, they're working on their designs. They seem very confident they're going to have something ready by the late part of this decade or 2030. And that's why 2030 is sort of this big marker as to when NASA wants to transition away from owning this kind of a space facility to just leasing whatever it needs, and other users will lease the rest of the capacity.
Now, the International Space Station, I think at some points has been seen as a symbol of, hey, sometimes even if we can't get along here on Earth, we can find ways to work together up there in space. Are you hopeful, maybe even just at that symbolic level, that there can be this kind of international cooperation, not just amongst allies, but even adversaries when it comes to something like this in orbit?
I think that is one of the signature accomplishments of the ISS, is keeping this partnership together over all these years. The space station program started in 1984, and Russia came in 1993, and it's had a lot of ups and downs over these decades. And the geopolitical relationship has been changing over those decades, not just right now with the current invasion of Ukraine, but in 2014 when Russia annexed Crimea. So there have been a lot of ups and downs, and this has been one little segment of geopolitical cooperation that has stayed the course. And I think there are a lot of people who are hopeful that it's going to continue to be able to stay out of the terrestrial geopolitical realm. It hasn't been 100%. When Rogozin was still running Roscosmos, he had the three cosmonauts who were up there wave flags for the two republics in Ukraine that Russia is claiming. And that was not good. And Russia, NASA responded to that saying it was inappropriate to do that. So maybe with Rogozin gone and Borisov taking it over, we won't see any more of that.
Marcia, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks very much for having me.
That's Marcia Smith, founder and editor of spacepolicyonline.com. She's got years of experience in space policy. She talked to us today about Russia's commitment to the International Space Station, the future of the ISS, and other potential orbital stations, and some confusion that came out from Russian announcements and the coverage here in the United States about the future of the space station. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, Kansas voters blocked an attempt to change their state's constitution. That change would have allowed a ban on abortions. Look at the decision, the margin among voters there, and what it might mean for abortion politics around the country in these midterm elections in 2022. And higher education is becoming a political football. How did it get that way? The author of a new book breaks down the cultural and political divides around college and the history that led us here. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then a UW psychology professor joins us to share research on emotional distress from scrolling through the news and what we can do to stay informed without being dragged down. I'm Rob Ferris. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, after U.S. drone strike killed an Al-Qaeda leader in Kabul, a national security expert explains how and why U.S. counterterrorism policy has changed in the 20 years since the September 11th attacks. First, keeping up with the news can bring you a lot of doom and gloom, depending on where you look. Especially at the start of the pandemic, it felt like one bad news story after another. That can have a real negative impact on our mental health. But it can also be important for us to stay informed about the world around us. Our next guest today conducted a study looking at the emotional distress associated with high amounts of news consumption in early 2020. We'll try to figure out how we can best keep up with the news without letting it bring us down. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you ever find yourself getting bogged down by scrolling through bad news, maybe on your phone, what they sometimes call doom scrolling? Does keeping up with the news have negative impact, or has it at some point, on your mental well-being? Do you have a way of drawing the line? Now I'm going to look. Now I'm going to take a break. Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Marcus Brower is a professor of psychology at UW-Madison. He co-authored this research with Devon Shaw, professor of journalism at UW-Madison. It was published in the International Journal of Environmental Research and Public Health. Marcus, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with your study. What were you trying to find out here?
We wanted to find out how consumption of different type of media was related to emotional distress. So we examined how much people spend time on social media. It was based on self-report, how much time they spent on social media. We asked them how many hours of television they consumed per day. And then finally, we asked them about their consumption of print media. And then we gave them another scale, which measured their emotional distress. How anxious are you? How often do you think about negative things? Are you fearful? Are you depressed? Do you not feel well, et cetera? And what we found is that there was a positive relationships between, positive relationship between, on the one hand, media consumption, and on the other hand, emotional distress. And that relationship was positive. So the more somebody spent time consuming media, the more emotionally distressed they were. And that study was conducted in the early weeks of the pandemic, so March and April of 2020. So in that time of great uncertainty, time of where people didn't really know what was going on, we actually sort of had hoped for the opposite effect. We had hoped that those who stay informed and find out more about COVID and the infection risks and way to protect themselves, that they would experience less emotional distress. Well, we found the exact opposite. The more time people spend on consuming media, the more distressed they were.
I could see this going both ways. Maybe if I'm more upset and worried about COVID, say at that point in time, I might be the person who goes to the media more to try to find out more about it. Or it could even be, you know, this downward spiral. Reading more gets me more anxious. Being more anxious makes me read more. Is there something to that?
Yes. The causality probably works in both directions. Those who are emotionally distressed, as a way to deal with that distress, consume more media. And at the same time, media consumption, given the inherent negativity of what we are exposed to, then leads to greater emotional distress. So it's a correlational study. We can't draw causal conclusions from a correlational study, but I think you're entirely right. Probably the causality works in both directions. They mutually influence each other, and there could be something like a downward spiral. Yes.
When you looked at how much time people were spending on media, at the upper limits, how much was there? How hooked did some of us get on the news?
Oh, you would be surprised. I mean, there are some people who report spending 12, 14 hours per day checking for news. Of course, these are self-reports. We don't know what they really do, but some people are on their phones, or I don't know, some people are retired or don't have other things that they have to attend to. And they would spend, according to their self-reports, the entire day checking media. These were the exception. I mean, we just had a few. 12 and 14 hours, but you'd be surprised.
Well, and there's something about media on social media where it's bottomless, in a sense, right? You keep scrolling, it keeps giving you more stuff. Do you worry that a physical newspaper, at some point you run out of stuff to read? Do you worry that that infinite capacity of, say, a social media news feed can reinforce this kind of behavior?
Definitely. And I would say what also reinforces it is these algorithms of social media platforms. I mean, the goal is to get people to come back. So these algorithms are written that what is presented to consumers is what makes them come back and what makes them spend more time on that social media platform. And it just turns out that negative information, drama, things that makes people scared, that upsets them, that is distressing to them, will get more views, will get more clicks, will get shared, will be shared more often, will be at least noted more often, etc. And as a result, these negative things are disproportionately displayed on these social media platforms. So it is definitely the case, the more time you spend on your social media platform, the more likely you are to be distressed. And that is actually what we had sort of predicted. We didn't predict it with television and definitely not with newspapers, but actually for social media, that was exactly what we predicted. The more people spend time on social media, the more distressed they would be. And I think there are now numerous studies that show that that has actually nothing to do with COVID or the pandemic. That is generally the case. Actually, spending time on social media does not make people happy. First of all, if you look what your friends and peers and connections are doing, it always looks so great what they are doing. Everybody else seems to be having fun except you. So there's that social comparison aspect with other people in one's social environment. Then there is the whole political discussion where you're exposed to people with arguments that are not always go very far. And finally, there's the third aspect, which is what I just mentioned, is how these algorithms prefer negative information, prefer information that's distressing to us. And that's what gets primarily displayed.
We're talking to UW-Madison psychology professor Marcus Brower about his recent study co-authored finding a correlation between news consumption and emotional distress. This came from the start of the pandemic. It didn't end there, though. And we want to hear your own personal research at 800-642-1234. Is this a thing for you? Has it been a thing for you where you get hooked on a news story, on reading maybe about something bad, and you realize it is affecting your emotional well-being, your mental well-being? Or do you scroll through a social media feed and pretty soon a lot of time has passed and you realize you don't feel really any better than when you started? Have you set guidelines for yourself or maybe for your kids on how to, you know, keep up but not let it bring you down? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Are there things that we in the media could do to present the stuff and not have it be so depressing? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Marcus Brower, UW-Madison psychology professor, who co-authored a study looking at the connection between news consumption and emotional distress at the beginning of the pandemic. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you ever find that reading or watching or listening to or following the news on social media brings you down, makes you feel worse? Makes you feel bad, but you want to keep up anyway. Do you have thoughts on how to do both of those things at the same time? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Before we go to our callers, Marcus, do you have thoughts? I mean, I want to keep up with the news. I kind of have to for my job. I also don't want to be miserable. Do you have thoughts on how we can do both of those things at the same time?
One solution is to focus on how to solve problems rather than the problems themselves. So think of the early days of the pandemic. There was a lot of negative information, what happened in New York and the morgues being overfilled. Okay, you can focus on that. And that is, again, very attention grabbing to do that. And it's very worrisome. You sort of have a natural tendency to do that. Well, the other possibility is that you focus on, okay, let me find out what I can do. There's always a risk. I mean, life inherently contains risk. So let me now see how I can reduce these risks. What can I do? What is the latest piece of information on masks? Should I be wiping down my groceries with disinfectant wipes? Should I stay away from people? Do I need to stay 6 feet away outdoors? What is the information? So what is the current state of the research on how I can reduce infection risk? And probably knowing that it will never be zero in a situation like that. So instead of focusing on the drama and the negative outcomes, why not focus on the solutions and how to reduce risk?
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Laura is with us in Manitowoc. Laura, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Gosh, I mean, I've totally had the experience that your guest is talking about, but I think really more than the news content itself or any news story that's out there, I mean, I think people are completely capable of handling, you know, the really disturbing things that have been going on. I think the really upsetting thing and the thing that gets to people is really other people's reactions to the news stories. So what's different now is on social media, you know, back in the day, you'd watch the news and then you were kind of left to discuss it in person or whatever. But now, of course, you have this real-time discussion going on. And whether people agree with your take on a news story or not, people can just be really horrible in those comment sections. And I think that's really what's distressing to people and that people have a hard time dealing with.
Laura, thanks for that call. What do you think, Marcus?
I think you're entirely right. I have four teenage sons, and I keep telling them, surround yourself with people who make you feel good, not with people who make you feel bad. And I think that applies also to this situation. I think there are certain people in our environment, doom and gloom, and everything is terrible, and we're all going to die, and we're all doomed, and there's nothing we can do, and it's hopeless, and it's a disaster. or we can surround ourselves with people who have a more positive outlook, a more problem-solving outlook, and try to address the situation, or who have an accurate assessment of risk probabilities, because that's actually also one important point is how we accurately assess probabilities of infection or other kinds of risk factors. So I entirely agree. We know we are social animals. We know that we are influenced by others, and we know that what others think can have a large impact on our emotions. And this is where other people are incredibly important. First of all, who you surround yourself with, but also sometimes you can ask for what you need. So if you feel upset, like in a conversation, a family meeting, or et cetera, if you feel upset about the current situation and people just keep talking about that, you can say, hey, I'm actually not doing so well right now. And what would really help me is if we talked a little bit about that, or if we focused more on this topic or an entirely different topic, rather than discussing for the 10th time how many people have died and what the current situation is and how bad it is. So I entirely agree as a social psychologist, because that's what I am. I of course think that we're very influenced by what our other people do in our environment, but we also have some impact on who our environment is, both in person and on social media.
Laura, thanks for that call. We'll go to Rohan now in Milwaukee. Rohan, hi.
Oh, well, thank you for perfect timing. I wanted to add on to what the previous caller talked about and to say that's a really interesting analysis about the algorithms. Before the algorithms and before trolling on comment sections, after 9/11, a very interesting study was done that found a positive correlation between people's media consumption. So that this was a time of less entertainment news and more actual journalism, you know, like NPR does. So there was a positive correlation between people's consumption of mass media. An inverse relationship between their consumption of mass media and negative stereotypes about Muslims. So the more people consume media, the less likely they were to have negative stereotypes about Muslims. And so the news, our consumption of the news really has changed, right?
Rohan, interesting point, Marcus, a little different than the research but that you just did. But do you have thoughts on that?
Yes, the person who could really answer that is my co-author, Professor Devon Shaw here in the School of Journalism. It could be, and it really depends on the topic, that medias have changed. And the question is what that study is about. Is that television media? Is that print media? Because there are actually huge differences between these types of media. And then social media is yet another entirely different chapter. So it could be that television and newspapers have changed their reporting style, because even you mentioned 9/11. Many of the newspapers nowadays are online. So what's being counted is the number of clicks on each of the articles. And if a journalist keeps writing articles that nobody clicks on, well, their manager is going to talk to them and say, hey, what's going on? How come nobody's reading your article? So even journalism, I would say, has changed over the last 10, 12 years. And I think the incentive structure has changed tremendously. And I think journalists are incentivized more nowadays than 10, 15 years ago to focus on drama, to focus on negative outcomes, to focus on distressing news that upset us. Why? Because these distressing news create the clicks. And the same is true with a show like this. I mean, there is going to be a podcast later on. Who's going to click on the podcast? How often is it going to be downloaded? So I think the incentive structure for even classic media like newspapers, print media, and to some extent also television has changed drastically in the last 10 years.
Rohan, thanks for calling. And Marcus, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Of course. Goodbye.
That's Marcus Brower, professor of psychology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He was with us today to share his recent research on emotional distress and levels of news consumption, looking at the start of the pandemic in particular and learning lessons beyond that, talking about how we can keep up with the news without letting it get us down. And there's still time for you to share your answer to that dilemma, head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page. Have you found a way to manage your news diet where you can keep up with the world but not be overwhelmed by the bad news that's out there? Again, share your thoughts. You could email ideas@WPR.org or head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page. Wisconsin Public Radio was planning to air profile stories this week on four candidates in the Democratic primary for U.S. Senate. Then, last week, three of them dropped out, throwing their support behind Democrat Mandela Barnes in the process. Bridget Bowden has the story on how the race changed pretty much overnight.
University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee Professor Emeritus Mordecai Lee has been keeping up with elections in Wisconsin since he was a student in the 1960s.
So I've got sort of a good half century worth of memories of how things have been going.
And Lee was surprised when three Democratic candidates who had been running for U.S. Senate for more than a year all dropped out of the race last week.
This has been an astonishing development.
Outagamie County Executive Tom Nelson was the first to announce his exit from the race last week. On Monday morning, he said he was dropping out for financial reasons.
We ran out of money, so it was a question of, do we limp across the finish line and not win, or do we face facts?
Nelson believes that he started a domino effect with the other candidates, especially Milwaukee Bucks executive Alex Lazary, who dropped out just 2 days later. Money wasn't an issue for Lazary, the son of a billionaire who had poured more than $12 million of his own wealth into his campaign. Lazary said internal polling was showing that he was just not going to beat Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes.
This wasn't something where I thought we lost, right? I think Mandela won. And we'll see on August 10th, the final results. But like, I think what prevented us from ever getting, over the hump was the broad coalition of support that the lieutenant governor has.
State Treasurer Sarah Godlewski was the only woman on the ballot. The day Lazary dropped out, she said she had no plans to end her own campaign. But by the end of the week, she had decided to call it quits.
I mean, for me, it was something that I reflected on within literally the last 24 hours. And I know that we're better when we all come together, and that's why, for me, it was pretty immediate.
All three of the candidates endorsed Barnes. And although there are a few other candidates still running, Barnes is all but certain to be the one to face Republican U.S. Senator Ron Johnson in November's general election. UW-Milwaukee's Lee says it's not hard for the three to appear united in their support for Barnes, because for the most part, they had kept the campaign positive. Nelson had taken some shots at the other candidates, but the race wasn't defined by attack ads.
The fact that they decided not to do it was almost unnatural in terms of just the reality of politics. But the fact that they decided they didn't want to go negative is an indication of maybe sort of things are shifting, at least within the culture of the Democratic Party.
It's a stark contrast to the Republican primary for governor, Lee says, where former Lieutenant Governor Rebecca Clayfish has attacked businessman Tim Michaels, and Michaels has responded in kind.
I'm just astonished by how vicious they are and how powerfully advocative they are and just dredging up just about anything they can think of.
Lee says candidates in Wisconsin usually stay in the race through Election Day, even if they know they're going to lose. Losing hasn't always been a bad thing, he says. Famed Wisconsin Democrat William Proxmire lost three elections for governor in the 1950s. He even talked about losing in stump speeches. Eventually, he became Wisconsin's longest-serving U.S. senator. But Lee says that was a different time. Beyond just helping Barnes, these candidates likely thought ending their campaigns could end up helping them.
To avoid being tagged with the moniker of a loser, so-and-so is a loser, I think they sort of decided to drop out early, not spend any more money, and sort of stay alive to fight another day.
Lee says that could keep their options open if they run another political campaign in the future, whatever it might be. Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Tomorrow, WPR will have a story about Democratic Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes, and you can read our stories on the Republican candidates for governor at WPR.org. Coming up after the news, we'll look at the evolution of U.S. counterterrorism policy in the two decades since 9/11 after the death in Kabul of a longtime al-Qaeda leader in a U.S. drone strike. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.